Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through.
Hello, folks. Thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the Growing Conservative Conversation, and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find us on the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. Check out all the things that it offers, not only the members of there, but also the general public as well, and see some of the events and crusades done by the Patriot Journalist Network. So also another member to check out is Refugee Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. So find us at www.patriotjournalist.com. And also check out the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com, and check out all of our different pages, including our Give page, which has some wonderful organizations on there, and also for you, the audience, to send cookies to the men and women of our military. So come tonight, call in at 347-945-7428. You can speak with me, the host, or some of our panelists, which include the founder of the Overpasses for America, James Neighbors, conservative activist Cindy Todd, and author Kelly Mordecai, along with our guest, Republican candidate for governor Bob Guzzardi, and our contributor, constitutional activist, speaker, and writer Dan Gray. And, of course, we will bring in other audience members to call in and join our roundtable discussion. So tonight, Bard's Logic welcomes gubernatorial candidate Bob Guzzardi to discuss constitutional limited government, taxes, and how it infringes on our individual freedom and autonomy, free markets, and parental choice in education. So please take a look at this grassroots conservative candidate. Mr. Guzzardi supports a number of conservative candidates and causes for their emphasis on supply side economics, and of course including effective tax cuts and a strong defense of Israel. Bob is a politically and socially active man who believes the ideas have power. This power, of course, is necessary to convey messages and from informed groups that will help educate and enlighten others. He also runs the website and blog, thelibertyblog.org. Bob also serves on the boards of the Middle East Forum, Zionist Organization of America, and Yorktown University. Bob also supports the Winewood Institute, Club for Growth, Camera, and, of course, the Synagogue, and Beth Hammerdross in Winewood. And, of course, remember, folks, Bard's Logic is the grassroots We the People show. But before I bring on my guest, I do have some news that, unfortunately, I didn't like to hear today. One of our former guests who was on, Tracy, she was the founder of the Angel Heart Farm. Now, what the Angel Heart Farm does or did was use equine therapy for children who had chronically ill or had terminal illnesses, and they were using that kind of therapy to try to, you know, boost the morale and, you know, doing some wonderful things. Now, Tracy is a cancer survivor, and, you know, she beat her fight with cancer, which was one of the impetuses of her starting her Angel Heart Farm organization. Unfortunately, I found out today, folks, that cancer has returned to her, and so she is back in the fight, And so for all of the audience members out there, if you would please take some time at some point in the evening, or if you're listening to the show on the archive, if you could spend some time putting out your positive thoughts, and if you are of a prayerful sort, if you can send out your prayers to her, I'm sure she would really appreciate it, and I will let her know if you're... So please keep Tracy from the Angel Heart Farm in your thoughts tonight and beyond, and wish her the best of hopes and in her battle. And it's really sad to hear that she has to fight through that again. So anyway, to try to lift that off my heart. So at this point in time, I'm going to open up the mic to, I've got a couple of callers in already, so we will open up here. Is this 215? Is this Mr. Ghazardi?
Yes, it is. How are you?
Great. I'm good. How are you? Thank you very much for coming
good.
To the show and giving me these few moments in the beginning to, you know, send out our thoughts for Tracy.
Great. That's good. Good to hear. Good to hear you're doing that.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, I just found that out today. I was talking to a friend of mine. She's from another organization we had here on the show called Cancer Free Kids today, and she informed me of the situation. But, you know, we're here to talk about some things with you, and so I will go ahead and start off with our interview questions for you, Mr. Ghazardi. And,
okay.
I expect to know, you are challenging Tom Corbett, am I pronouncing it right, I believe, in the Republican primary for the gubernatorial race in Pennsylvania. And I read in an article on Politics PA website stating that you're angry with Mr. Corbett's record. Could you elaborate on this? And is it in large part a reason you are running against him, or is there even more to it?
Well, let me just first say something. I was listening to your little comments about Tracy and this Angel's Heart Farm, and it puts everything in perspective. I mean, this is politics. It's serious. People get all excited, and I even get excited about it, but you have to remember that there's other things in this world, and politics isn't everything. But I'm in the race partially because I mean, there's several levels and several perspectives on this. One is that I am asking people to sign a petition for signatures to put me on the ballot on May 20th because I think that Republicans need and deserve a choice in the Republican primary. That's one point. I think the other factor that makes my candidacy viable is the fact that Tom Corbett's reelect numbers are 23%, according to a Franklin and Marshall poll in January, and then there's a Quinnipiac poll coming out today that Tom Corbett's numbers are worse than Rick Santorum's numbers were in 2006. When Rick Santorum ran against Bob Casey, he was underwater as far as compared to Casey's numbers. Tom Corbett is even further behind compared to Tom Wolf, who is apparently the Democratic front runner at this point. There's not a single poll in the last year that shows Tom Corbett beating any of the likely Democratic candidates, and particularly Alison Schwartz, Rob McCord, or Tom Wolf. So you can't predict the future in politics. Take some strange jumps, but the thinking is that Tom Corbett can't win in November. That means it takes off the table the usual argument, well, any Republican is better than any Democrat. In a Republican primary, obviously the Republican primary voter is skewed to thinking that the Republicans are better than the Democrats and would support a strong candidate who was likely to win in November. In this year, in this particular situation, here we are in mid-February, and Tom Corbett is not, his numbers are not ticking up. And so there now becomes an opening And when I say that I'm angry, I say angry and disappointed and somewhat hurt because Tom Corbett made promises, and specifically a promise not to, of no new taxes, no new fees. This is documented in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette article, and I personally heard him make the no new taxes pledge, partially in response to Sam Rohrer's challenge. And he violated that. He didn't keep his promise either with respect to the Marcellus Shale impact tax fee. It's called an impact fee, but it's a tax. But whether you call it a fee or a tax, Tom Corbett violated that pledge. There's a number of other fees that have been raised a little less dramatically. And then, of course, the latest is the increase in what's called the Corbett gas tax, which is in reality an increase in motorist fees, truckers' fuel, and truckers' fees, as well as other fees applied to motorists. So we keep seeing a violation of core promises, and none of the expectations. It's more on my campaign literature, I call it unfulfilled promise, Republican or conservative policies being enacted, and none of them have. Voter ID has been stopped by the courts, and you can say, well, that's the courts, but other states have had voter ID. Pennsylvania is not alone in a voter ID law. If we simply tracked and executed the way that other states have done it from we would have voter ID, and it makes perfect sense to most people that you show ID for almost anything, including voting. But we don't have it, and we don't have – the liquor stores are still controlled by the government. The government's in the liquor business. It's a strange business for the government to be in, and I think 48 other states have liquor sold retail. It's controlled. It's regulated. You know, we need a traffic cop. Nobody's saying that it should be laissez-faire, anything goes. But the government, as the owner of the retail distribution chain, and as the I think Pennsylvania is the largest purchaser of spirits, which I think means wine and hard liquor, in the world. And it's a strange role for the government, and there's all kinds of analysis showing that the taxpayer is not going to lose any money because the value of the stores, as well as the taxing, continues. The liquor will continue to be taxed. So, but the point is that there's a disappointment out there of all these unfulfilled promise that, you know, we thought, gee, this is really going to be great. After 8 years of Enron Dell, we're now going to have springtime. And nothing happened except higher taxes and more fees. And during the last 3 years, Tom Corbett has signed into legislation three bills, Act 130 of 2011, Act 193 of 2012, and Act 69 of 2013, which were votes to increase debt by $6.3 billion. He's also signed into law appropriations bills 10A, 11A, 12A, 13A, and 14A, which redistribute $500 million to billion-dollar private tax-exempt corporations, specifically Penn State, University of Pittsburgh, Temple University, Lincoln University, and the University of Pennsylvania. $500 million go to these favored five universities. And there's tuitions are continuing to rise. They're going to rise again this year at Penn State, and I think most of the subsidized universities. We have a separate 14-university state system of higher education, which are, in fact, government schools, and they're government schools. But these five are private enterprise, and they are getting $500 million a year, not to mention what $30 million of state money is going to Comcast to build the new $1.2 billion building in Center City, Philadelphia. $30 million is going to a billion, multi-billion, mega international conglomerate that owns, well, it's not a conglomerate, but a mega international corporation, a private corporation that owns NBC, MSNBC, and a host, and now has made a bid for Time Warner. This is a multi-billion-dollar organization, and the stockholders, many of them are multi-millionaires, if not billionaires, they're Obama supporters, and yet the taxpayers of Pennsylvania are forced to finance $30 million to this corporation. Corporations are supposed to be paying taxes, not receiving subsidies.
Corporate welfare.
It's corporate welfare, and government dependency is government dependency, whether it's for the rich or the poor. And this is endless. We have a $100 million Hollywood tax credit. So, you start going through these endless lists of corporate subsidies. Shell Cracker in Act 16 of 2012 is, and that's Act 85, it's entitled to Keystone Operating Zones, which means that its profits it's tax exempt from property taxes, and then it's getting over a 25-year period. I think it's a $1.7 billion in tax credits. This is another multi-billion-dollar mega international corporation. So between Comcast and Shell, there's billions of dollars and the universities, there's billions of dollars of taxpayer money that is redistributed. And I want to be the representative of the forgotten taxpayer. Taxation with representation. And the taxpayer has been forgotten in all of this. The taxpayer is forced to fund it. The pension system is just skyrocketing, and I just don't see how we avoid tax increases at both the state and the municipal level because of the increased need to fund these unfunded pension liabilities. The government's been unfunding them for years, I think for about more than seven to nine years. And this all goes back to 2001 under the Republican Ridge administration with a Republican General Assembly. Act 43 of 2001, and that was increased the pensions for all elected officials by 50% and all 300,000 state employees by 25%. Well, in those days, the stock market's going up. Well, people may have noticed, and more mature people may have noticed, the stock market goes up, and then it goes down, and it went down. And therefore, now the taxpayer has essentially guaranteed these pensions, and these pensions. So more and more money is being driven into the government sector. And, of course, they're going to spend money. This will increase the economy. Well, it's not working. Pennsylvania is not growing. It is not growing. Population is stagnant, and it's getting older, which means that there are fewer and fewer people that are actually working and producing the taxes that need to be paid. But you have Comcast, a hugely successful corporation that's getting subsidies, and it's not the only one. In my area, Smith Barney. They built their $10 million office. They had a $10 million subsidy from the Office of Economic Development in Philadelphia. Why are we giving $10 million to this multi-million-dollar corporation that? And it's not the only one. Keva got money. ShopRite got money. Tony Orlando of Tony Orlando and Dawn is the owner. Is a principal in a corporation in Delaware County that got I think $5 million. In the amounts of money that is being doled out, taxpayer money to corporations, is just astounding, and we still don't see any ratcheting up in the economic well-being of Pennsylvania for all these billions of dollars. And that's government welfare for the rich. Then you have the subsidies to the poor. You have the school system, which just sucks up money and doesn't increase its productivity. You have unions that are the iron workers union in Philadelphia is just exposed as the thugs that they are. It's astounding to read the stories. And even the Inquirer, which is a democratically owned newspaper, owned by George Norcross, who is very, very close to the unions, and it's astounding to see that the Obama administration indicted 10 iron workers for torching a $500,000 piece of equipment that was being used to renovate a Quaker meeting house. It was parked on Quaker meeting house property. and these thugs came up there and torched it. I mean, and there's endless stories of thuggery and intimidation by unions that barely ever gets prosecuted. So they continue to do what they want to do. They're driving up the cost. They have huge political power, both the building trades as well as the government unions like the PSEA. And there's a taxpayer out there that's just spinning his or her wheels and barely getting by. This fuel tax hammers trucking companies all over Pennsylvania, which not only hammers the trucking companies, but hammers all the employees of those trucking companies. And by raising the cost of fuel and fees for these trucking companies, raises the cost of goods and services or goods that are delivered by truck, which is almost everything. There's very, very there's very few. I mean, every grocery store is has its delivery by truck. So all over, and when you compare gas prices, Pennsylvania has the sixth highest gas price in the country. Now, why should that be? We have refineries in Philadelphia, and yet we're paying the sixth highest gas tax in the country. I have no idea why that is, but you keep loading people up with more and more expenses. There's less and less money saved, and the standard of living is slowly being eroded. Philadelphia, there was just a study by the Pew Foundation in Philadelphia how the middle class is disappearing, and that's been controlled by Democrats for over 50 years. And the same policies that are being used in Philadelphia are now being used at the state level, and the same result is going to happen. I mean, this is simple. For the last 6 years, the Commonwealth Foundation wrote an article. In the last 6 years, the government, the Pennsylvania state budget, has spent more than its revenues. Its expenditures have exceeded revenues for 6 years. So three of those years are Corbett years. So everybody's blaming Ed Rendell for this and Ed Rendell for that, but Corbett is spending more than is expending more than revenues. So when your expenditures exceed revenues year after year after year, what do you think is going to happen? It's either going to borrow more, which is just kicking the can down the road. Eventually, taxpayers are paying it. Pennsylvania is getting to be an older and older state, which means fewer and fewer people are engaged in productive work that is producing goods and services that other people need. So who pays for all this? What happens? And, you know, we're just slowly going toward this fiscal iceberg, which is right in front of us for somebody who's there, who wants to see what there is to be seen. People don't. They get all tangled up in all kinds of different things. But right ahead, Robert, right ahead is this fiscal iceberg. And you can talk about all kinds of other things, and it's still there. It's still there, and it's moving right forward to us, and nobody seems to be talking about it or jumping up and down or getting scared of nothing. I said, well, I will try to do my best to see if I can get on the ballot to so that the Republicans can have a competitive primary, bring up some of these issues, and if I win the nomination, which is possible, and not even possible, is there's a real reasonable likelihood given Tom Corbett's reelect numbers, then I have a chance to bring these issues out across the state and alert people to these issues in the fiscal iceberg that's facing us. And all the distractions go on about gay marriage, which is highly unlikely to happen in Pennsylvania, but it's a distraction. The same thing with guns. Guns are the Pennsylvania Constitution is very clear that the right of citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned. Article 1, Section 21. It's been in the state constitution, those words, since 1790. Out west, none of the Democrats are interested in any more gun control. They all own guns out west, Democrats and Republicans. So it's only in the southeast and certain elite areas that gun control comes up. And it's one of those issues everybody gets excited about, but there's really nothing, not that much to be excited about. I mean, you need to be aware of it. But the real threat is right in front of us, and it's a fiscal iceberg threat. Pensions, increasing costs of government at all levels, which means increased taxation, which means less money for productive taxpayers who work, save, and invest. And I just see this as a slow-rolling disaster. And it may be that people aren't as concerned about it because they don't see the erosion that's happening so slowly, and or young people just move out of state. My kids live out of state. One's in Texas, mm-hmm. one's in North Carolina. And why would they come back here? Why does anybody stay here? It's freezing cold. Florida's nice and warm right now. So, you know, why, there's a whole issue out there of the impact, and sort of because it's a slow-rolling thing. I don't know. I can't really explain it. I was out at a farmer's market today in Lewisburg, and some people are angry about some things, but I just don't get the feeling that they see or that we all see this fiscal disaster. Maybe, I don't know, I mean, some of the people that I work with are very clear about it. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem to be that sense of urgency that I would expect. But maybe, you know, the British people slept, England slept while the Germans rearmed, and then the bombs started to fall on London. They say, oops, we seem to have a problem. So maybe when Pennsylvania or a few more cities go bankrupt or there's not enough money to pay the pensions and
or
services are cut, more likely Harrisburg just is coming out of receivership like everything is all okay. Well, I don't think it's all okay. There's a ton of new debts. Bondholders and corporate counsel have done very well. There's a few people doing very well, but who pays for all of this new debt? Well, it's the taxpayer. And it goes mm-hmm. on. These are 20-year bonds. So when do we get out from under all of this debt? I mean, you have a mortgage, you pay it off in 20 years, and you're done. But the government debt is infinite. It just rolls over each year, and we never get rid of it. So we're paying high interest rates. A high percentage of the general fund budget goes to interest. It's not in. I don't think the general fund pays interest. The total budget of Pennsylvania is about $63 billion. And the total GDP of Pennsylvania is about $500 billion. So, yeah, that's right. And so we're paying a high percentage. Our budget, our state budget, is sucking up a high percentage of the state productivity. I mean, how long does this go on? And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm overreacting to all of this. I don't want to be an alarmist. But it seems to me that we're going in the wrong direction.
Well, it's definitely apparent, and the taxes is an important issue for you. And I see that you contend the taxes, quote from it, diminish individual freedom and autonomy. So if you could please elaborate on that point for our listeners.
Well, obviously, the less money you have, the less opportunity to do those things that you want to do. Pursuit of happiness means each person decides what they want to do. You want to do a radio show. Well, the less money you have is the less equipment you can buy, less people you can hire, fewer people that you can hire, less advertising that you do. So it impinges on your ability to pursue your own happiness. The more money the government takes the money. The government is the instrument of power and force in a society. And the more money it takes to fund itself, the less money there is for you to do what you want to do, whether it's have a radio show or whatever you want to do, buy a new car or, you know, different people want to do different things. Not everybody drives the same car. Not everybody takes the same path to happiness. So it just limits your own individual freedom and autonomy and, you know, your business, your home, everything is at risk when the government decides, you know, through whatever ways these things get decided. And I don't see a conspiracy. It just seems to grow. And, you know, there doesn't seem to be any concerted effort to slow the growth, which means the bigger government, the smaller the citizen. And that's where I see Pennsylvania going. But I see the risk as fiscal. I don't see it as being, you know, particularly, it's not an NSA type of thing. It's not the reduction of civil rights like taking your guns. It's a slow erosion of your economic freedom. And economic freedom is an important freedom, and that's what I see being eroded. So it's both a financial issue as well as a liberty issue, as far as I see it.
And also, you know, free markets are also on the forefront of your agenda. And do you believe, and it sounds like you may, that the country is, or do rather, is actually moving away from this, moving away from the free markets And if you could set some more examples of these, and how do you believe we can turn the ship around?
Well, when you say free market, I don't mean a laissez-faire market, but you know, we do need a traffic cop. You have a traffic cop to make sure that traffic flows smoothly, but you don't have the traffic cop telling you which way to go and when you can drive on the highways or where you're supposed to go. So we do need a regulated regulation in that sense to prevent fraud and force. But basically, the economy is more regulated. We have, in 2012, there were 225 new laws, including 14 appropriations bills. 2013, I think there were 193 new general acts and 14 appropriations bills. I mean, there's endless numbers of new laws and regulations. Common Core, for example, is a huge regulatory intrusion and imposition on the education system. So we've moved far, far, far away from any kind of regulation to a real intervention into the market system. Parents don't choose, can't choose what kind of schools they go to because the government says you all have to teach Common Core or whatever standards it decides are the preferred standard du jour. So I think, and what we could do about it is if we elect a governor who says no, and the government does a governor does have a line item veto. The governor, governor doesn't sign the budget, as Ed Rendell did for years, a number of years ago. Well, then the government goes to shutdown. Okay, and that's one way of reducing costs. It's perhaps a painful way and a illogical way, but that can happen. But the governor has the power to say no, and to use a veto, a line item veto, and say no. Things like automatic dues deduction, which would eliminate the special privilege, the unique privilege that a private organization has. Unions are private organizations, entirely private. They are not government organizations, and yet the government uses its power to automatically deduct dues from workers' paychecks. Well, first of all, if unions were so good, why do workers have to be forced to join them and pay for them? Something they don't want and may not need. And number two is, how is it that the government is collecting dues for a private organization? No other organization has this privilege. The government extracts its own tax because the government is a institution of force and power in the society. So it's understandable. That's what a tax is. It means you pay it without involuntarily, even though you do have representation, still involuntary. But the dues deductions, I mean, it's unheard of, except for unions, and everybody seems to accept it. And the governor enters into contracts with government employees, and this is a matter of contract. He could say, no more automatic dues deductions. It's not going to be part of this contract. We'll talk about wage increases and benefits increases and worker hours of employment and work rules, but we're not going to agree to automatic dues deduction. If Scott Walker approved, could be done in an even bluer state than Pennsylvania. And when workers were given the choice, they decide they weren't going to join a union. But many workers will join a union. So the idea is to eliminate the coercive nature of union membership and union dues deduction in government employment. The government should not be forcing people to join an organization they don't want to join and pay for something they don't want. This is not a liberty. It's not the liberty agenda.
No, certainly I agree. And moving on, we can touch more on this later on the show. We got plenty of time, but I want to go through these questions here so we can bring in some of the panelists and our contributors here for the show. But politically, you know, we'll switch gears over to the politics of it, and the state GOP and the National Republican Governors Association are backing Corbett, and it appears to me, probably to many of the listeners, that this is just another example of the GOP establishment supporting their guy instead of their grassroots base. No, I presume maybe you would, but would you agree with this observation? Why not?
Yeah, and one of the things that many of the state committee people want but have not been able to get yet is a competitive primary. essentially the state endorses a candidate, and this means that there is no party that any challenger is shut out of any resources. They're very difficult to get signatures at any kind of official Republican event. But a competitive primary is what the market's about. You compete in the market of ideas. And the state GOP does everything it can to keep its insider network going. So I see that is a major problem. And the reason that Corbett's numbers are so down is that this has alienated much of the Republican base and has alienated other voters who are now either re-registered as Democrat or, in many cases, re-registered as independents or libertarians, who see that there is a fiscal problem that's not being addressed by the Republican Party. And I think that my candidacy is a way of reforming the Republican Party. But it is definitely a closed network. And I don't see this serving either the party or the Republican base very well, or the citizens of Pennsylvania.
And also, I'm sure there'll be some folks asking questions about, you know, this, is that there's also an article that I stated that said that you were angry with Mr. Corbett, also said that you funded some Democrats against Republicans you thought were undermining conservative principles. Do you believe this is an example of the ideal principle over party? Why or why not?
Well,
I
did that a long time ago because there was some strategic reasons to do that. For example, there was a hack named Tom Gannon in Delaware County, and a Democrat, Brian Lentz, was running against him. I gave Brian money because I wanted to get Gannon out of there. I felt similar to what I'm doing now, that it's necessary to remove certain people from the GOP establishment if there's going to be reform. The same thing's happening in Senate District 28, where Scott Wagner is running a very, very, very competitive race, and the governor and the lieutenant governor and former Senator Mike Waugh and Representative Ron Miller and the chair of the York County Republicans, Rob Wilson, are collaborating together to manipulate a special election and the primary election because they know Scott Wagner can't be controlled. And you see this. So right now I see my role more in helping, and I was a contributor to Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, who supported John McGinnis against Rick Geist in the Altoona area. Rick Geist had been held office for 34 years.
Wow.
We were involved in the primary race with Robert Jubilier and then with Mike Fulmer against Chip Brightville, both of which I think moved the ball ahead a little bit more. But the Republicans have not learned their lesson. Now I just want to be clear that the Democrats have been very honest and clear about their roles. I mean, all of them want to tax more. They want to tax Marcellus Shale. They want to, fund education more. I mean, it is very clear that they have a tax and spend agenda, that they think more government is an effective way to improve lives, even though the evidence seems to be the contrary. But they're very clear that they want more government. More government means more government expense, which means higher taxes. Because who finances government but the taxpayers? So the Democrats are very, very clear what they want to do. I frequently say Democrats can't be trusted with money. They just don't understand where it comes from. They think it's a limitless tree. So you have that, and the only way to stop it is to have Republicans who are willing to say no. It costs too much and we can't afford it. No. We're not going to do it. We don't have that. We have Republicans that negotiate and bipartisan. Bipartisan is another word for tax increase. What I see. So I'm taking the position, no new spending. We're not going to do it. Veto. And let's see what happens. And it will be painful. I'm not so sure that the taxpayers of Pennsylvania are ready for this, but I want to get these ideas out there and have people start to think about it. And that you should have choice in a primary. Why should it be, just one, just like having one store in town that you can't, you can only go to this one store. You can't go to, you don't have any choice. You have to go to Walmart. You want no Costco, no Target. I mean, we're used to having many, many choices and many, many, and it's like one car dealership. So why should we only have one candidate on the ballot? You don't have to vote for me, but sign the petition so you have someone who's talking about these various subjects, because Corbett sure won't. And the Democrats, of course, think that we're not spending enough, which means we're not taxed enough. That's just what they think. They all say it. And there's not much difference between any of the Democrats on policy. They're all pretty much the same. But certainly on tax and spend, they're all the same.
Oh, yeah. We're seeing that on the national level as well. We're also hearing this a lot. And, of course, you know, you heard this too, where another article says Corbett needs to unite his base, then he needs to appeal to the moderates. Now, we see this time and time again, and I believe, isn't this the problem that faces conservatives and the grassroots in the Republican Party? It appears that, you know, we fight and retreat, and to the end up where conservatives either stay at home or hold their noses in an election. So what I like to do is...
And I think there was,
what ought to be done to end that vicious cycle?
Well, I think what's usually said by that is they go conservative and speak to the base in the primary and then swivel to the moderates in a general. But that is – and what it means is selling out your principles in the general election. And after a while, the base figures that out. Well, you're telling me in the primary, just as Tom Corbett said, no new taxes, no new fees. He gets into office and he imposes new taxes and new fees. What it can mean is that you adhere to certain principles that the base supports: limited government, lower taxes, economic freedom, personal responsibility in accordance with biblical values. Those are that's the principles on which the country was built. And both the Pennsylvania and the National Constitution talk about rule of law, separation and balance of powers. There are three branches of government. And the legislature is not, and the governors seem to not be as independent of one another as they should be. But then, once you win the primary, then you find common ground. The idea in a general election is to find common ground without compromising your core principles, and that is what never happens. When they swivel in the general. Or get elected, they abandon their basic principles, and they only pretend to come back to them as Tom Corbett is pretending to come back in the primary. And I think the base is, and the fact that, you know, we'll see if I get on the ballot and how well I do, but I'd like to see this as a test of the power of the grassroots to contend with the almost impenetrable inner insider network. So the problem is not shoring up with the base and going to the moderates. It's the fact that when you go moderate, you've abandoned your principles and, of course, abandoned the base. What you need to do is to stay true to your principles of limited government and find common ground. There's a lot of Democrats that are sick of the corruption at the Turnpike Commission, for example. There's, 8 or 10 that are being indicted and are headed for trial, that's sick of the Sandusky trial of Graham Spanier and the other two Penn State officials that are being tried for covering up the Sandusky scandal. This is common ground. Many people see this corruption. Of course, the Democrats see it as what we need is a better bureaucracy, and what I see is limited government, so we differ on the solution. But they certainly see the same problem. And once they find somebody that's honest, I think they will be less inclined to jump up and down. The unions, of course, will demonize anybody who dares suggest that they should take less money, God forbid. But you just can't cave into that, because as soon as you do, then you've abandoned the forgotten taxpayer again, which is what Corbett did.
And you've mentioned general elections, and, of course, you know, general election I'm going to be speaking of is, how important do you think it is for the 2016 presidential election, for there to not only be a Republican in the governor's mansion, but a conservative governor. What impact do you think it can have on that race?
Well, there's two questions there. I'm hearing two questions. One is, it would be great to have a conservative governor like Scott Walker in Pennsylvania, because then you would have somebody speaking in a coordinated and coherent way about limited government, lower taxes, economic freedom. And that would then build a base to help elect a national president with the same values. There's a second level, and that is my candidacy is the odds of any Republican winning in November are pretty slim. And Tom Corbett's numbers are not only Corbett's numbers, but they're Republican numbers. Tom Corbett and the Republican General Assembly have managed to weaken the Republican Party tremendously, and they really undercut the party. And by having a weakened party, this makes it more difficult for Pennsylvania to elect a Republican to go Republican in a national election. So I'm looking at my candidacy as being part of the long game, that it's 2016 and even 2018. And it's not only just the governor's office, it's just at the state level, at the House and Senate level. Elect people like Scott Wagner in York 28. Elect people like John McGinnis and other limited government challengers. Elect Art Halverson to the U.S. House. And, of course, that's a national election, but the fact is that he will be coalescing a limited government base. And that's the kind of thing that because what it does is you'll have somebody speaking about these issues in a principled fashion and demonstrating, I hope, to the electorate that the principles of limited government improve their lives dramatically. And that the principles of bigger government that suck more and more of your tax dollars to a bureaucracy, a very inefficient and overpaid bureaucracy, lower their standard of living. And I just don't think that case has been made. Corbett certainly doesn't do it. So I hope that, you know, if I win the nomination, I will have an opportunity to speak to these subjects to a larger audience. And so I'm looking at the long game of 2016 and 2018 and even beyond. So this is like every election, everything you do counts. It affects yourself, it affects people immediately in contact with you, it affects the country, and perhaps a little mystical to think that it affects the unseen reality, but I think it does. I think it has a long-term impact beyond anything that we know. So you try to do the best you can and hope God does the rest.
And we definitely need, and I'm thinking as conservatives and grassroots, a long-term strategy, and that's definitely something the liberals have done for quite some time. But I want to say that at the top of the hour, in about 12 minutes, we do have our contributors and panelists that I will be bringing in to ask questions as well. And I see Dan on the line, our constitutional activist, and he'll be having some questions and comments. We also have, and we'll have him on, and then we'll have Kelly Mordecai, our panelist, author, and then I see we have Cindy Todd in as well, our conservative activist. And also, if there's anyone in the audience who would like to chime in, just call at 347-945-7428. If you have any questions or comments, and you can join our roundtable discussion that we'll be starting in about 11 minutes, and that is 347-945-7428. So I've got one more question we'll ask here and that I've got listed, and then I'll bring some others in later if we have time. But I want to bring up other issues that are important to you, such as you mentioned, limited government, pro-growth policies, constitutional limited government spending, as you mentioned, but also talk about the individual empowerment, personal autonomy, which we did touch on, and one maybe talk more about in the next 10 minutes is personal responsibility. And so why do you, and you could tell us why you believe these are important, and do you think, as what many would say, are American traits that are fading away? And if so, how can we bring these American values back to, you know, America?
The answer to that is a huge problem. There's problems with the culture and My answer is I don't have any grand vision for this, but what I think is that we each do the best we can. I hope that what I'm doing is making a difference, even being on this radio show and talking to people about it will have some kind of long-term difference, and it will emanate out there, and that you'll give that I'll be able to give some small voice to the forgotten taxpayers and to the limited government people who want to conserve the Constitution. But it's so far, I mean, there's so many things that have blown out of control that the reason I focus on spending is because I think it's the most imminent issue and because I think the governor can really do something about it. And I think the same thing with automatic dues deduction. The governor can actually do something. He doesn't need the legislature to when he renegotiates a contract. He can set an example by doing it with state contracts. So I think that each person does the best they can, and we hope that things change, and maybe they won't. I mean, England slept, and the bombs fell on London. So sometimes the collective wisdom is wrong, and so I hope by talking about it that people will hear it, and in an opportune moment, perhaps we'll see a big change. But I don't see. I think each of us tries to do the best he or she can, and then hope that God does the rest of it in whatever way that's supposed to work out. I just can't tell you what to do. Pennsylvania is 12 million people. I've talked to a lot of people, and you know, you're letting me talk and give you my viewpoint, but I can tell you I don't usually get this far. Everybody has their own agenda, what they think is important. One guy thought being right to work state was just a terrible, nice guy. We thought it was a terrible, terrible idea. So, you know, to change that whole mentality is, and to persuade people is just a long-term problem that starts now, and, you know, we'll see what happens and see how it plays out. But for the time being, this is what I'm doing. I'm doing the best I can. I hope I can get enough signatures to get on the ballot and make my case as best I can. But and then, you know, other people get distracted. You'll see, you know, you have the property tax people that want to eliminate property tax that are fixated on that. You have the social issues that blind people, the pro-life community is a one-issue community, or a lot of people are one-issue community. Meanwhile, they're voting for people that raise taxes, which I think is counter to the basic message of the sanctity of the individual, but many of the pro-life people don't see that. Every one of the Lancaster delegation, all of whom are pro-life, voted for the $2.4 billion corporate gas tax increase. So I think that's part of the problem. That's even within the Republican and conservative base, there are people that tax and spend, even if they're pro-life. So I'm trying to convince pro-life people that it is consistent and more consistent with their philosophy to vote for lower taxes, and vice versa. The lower taxes is a question of individual liberty and the sanctity and the value of every individual life. Every individual life. Life begins at conception. Well, if it doesn't, if life doesn't begin at conception, what does? So, you look at these things, and that's why I talk a little bit about values, because you can't have self-government without self-restraint. And moral restraint comes from, in my opinion, from God. Other people seem to be very restrained and come from other sources. But to me, the moral law it comes from an unseen reality. Perhaps you don't want to call it a Judeo-Christian reality, although I do. But it has to be anchored in self-restraint. And anything goes, and, you know, do what you feel like doing is a recipe for disaster, as we see in large parts of our communities around the state. So I think that you have to talk about values. Values are critically important. And if you believe in individual responsibility, that means you don't take money from the government. Unless, you know, there may be times when you need a social safety net, and I don't think I'm not recommending or thinking radical reduction in government welfare, although it certainly can be used more effectively. But a lot of it is completely wasted. This Office of Economic Development, Dwight Evans in Philadelphia, I mean, there's millions and millions and millions of dollars being wasted that could actually have a real impact. If that money were used for vouchers for all, where inner city kids could choose what schools they want to go to, or you made a charter school system that was much more competitive, I think that that would be go a long way to start to change attitudes. But it's been a long time in coming, and I don't really have any magic bullet. I just do the best I can and hope other people will go along with me.
But before I bring Dan in, when it comes to, vouchers for schools, I used to be supportive of that, but how things have turned out here, at least in my locality, is it's been unfortunate because, they do have a voucher system here for, if there's a child who lives in a failing school, they'll, give the parents a voucher where they can move into, where they can send their children to, another school, maybe even a private school. And in some ways that's good, but I have seen instances where, that happens where, the kids come in and they just really change the school and not a lot for the better just because the way, the parents are. I mean, I'm kind of a believer of, you sacrifice to send your kids to, better schools, things of that nature. Monetarily, you give up having some of the better things so you can, use that money for the tuition of, of better schools.
I'm not sure what you're referring to. Vouchers for all means that if you don't like the school, just like if you don't like a particular car dealership, you may buy a car from a different company because you like the dealership. The idea that you have open enrollment and kids move from one district to another. Yeah, but that's what public means. I mean, this idea of segregating people by zip code is not education. And I understand I understand what you're talking about. But vouchers would say you can take this money and go to a private school if there's an opening, or you'll find, I think, schools starting to develop once there's vouchers and money out there. And it is a redistribution of wealth. But the Constitution of Pennsylvania has that built into it, the thorough and efficient system of public education. So, I just think it's more efficient and certainly gives parents more rights. And the fact that it doesn't work perfectly, well, that's to be expected. It's not going to work perfectly. If you think that this is not, I'm not offering this as any kind of magic bullet, but it is a step towards greater autonomy for parents, and it's not much worse than the system we already have. I mean, that's the problem right now. You look around and you see a system that is in decline, and I just don't know any other solution. I mean, what, more money for the government schools and more money for the government school teachers? I haven't seen that improve education for anybody. You look at Philadelphia, and you see a real movement in Philadelphia from the government schools to charter schools. I think there's something like, on the official site, I remember reading this year, it's 60,000, and then there was a newspaper article in the Inquirer of all places, I think it was up to 64,000, which is about more than one-third of the children of school-age K to 12 children in Philadelphia. So the parents, when given a choice, choose charter schools. And you see, I've been down in Florida, and there's charter schools all over the place. So, I mean, part of the problem is the transition. You're going to have this disruption. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. It's not going to be perfect.
We could have Cindy, talk more about. She's from Florida, so we can, ask her to talk more about the charter schools and things of that nature when we bring her on. But at this point, I am going to bring in our contributor, Dan, who's also from Pennsylvania. And so, Dan, okay. Thank you very much for calling to the show. How are you?
I'm great. I have to say, first of all, Bob, and they're both Bob tonight, Bob Jetter, your show gets better every week. It's really, really fun to listen to.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
And Bob Guzzardi, I want to, in the interest of full disclosure, I know Bob Guzzardi personally, and so this is not like I'm just talking to some candidate here. You've always had really good ideas, but I have to say you're really hitting your stride. I would so love to see you in a debate with all these progressive candidates out there, because you're not just using talking points. These are thoughtful points.
Exactly. That's one of the points that I make, that if I win the nomination, and right now my challenge is to get petitions signed, but if I win the nomination, I can say, generally speaking, whatever the Democrats want, I don't.
Well, and quite a few Republicans as well.
Right,
I do want to make a comment on your economics, and I am sure that Pennsylvania voters are ready for liberty and fiscal responsibility. I am enjoying listening to you expound on an overview instead of just looking at all these little hot-button topics. I deal with this on a daily basis, pro-life and pro-Second Amendment, et cetera. And the overview is that money trumps all. The history that we learned.
At this point in time, certainly, yes.
History is it would laud the founders who fought, but it fails to give honor to those whose industry built America, who made it strong. Our governor, Benjamin Franklin in Pennsylvania, was not just a tremendously brilliant man who invented things. He was not just a diplomat and a military guy in his early life before our revolution. He was a very successful businessman who helped build and promote all kinds of institutions, voluntary institutions, and it was that liberty that created the prosperity that gave us the strength. And the reason I do think that Pennsylvania voters are ready is they're starting to really wake up and realize, because it's hitting them so hard, all this non-existent inflation that isn't counted anymore, all these unemployed people who aren't counted anymore. Overall, slavery is profiting from the sweat of another person's brow and not willingly. And that's what we've got here, is economic slavery of the forgotten taxpayer, as you mentioned, because they're taking – forget just what you see in your paycheck. Forget the FICA tax and the Social Security tax and the payroll tax. Look at the local tax. Look at your phone bill. Look at your utility bill. Look at your receipt at when you go to the store if you're buying anything other than food and a few necessities. Everywhere you turn, there's a fee, there's a tax, and it's astounding. It's entirely regressive, too, because a poor person has no chance to save any money and get ahead, because the vast majority of they earn from their work is taken from them to be used by these experts who seem to know better, but as you say, spend the vast majority of the money on themselves and on welfare programs, whether it's for poor people or the corporate welfare programs like you were mentioning. So I have a question. Since building things is what you've done, you're a real estate guy, you're a businessman, you've built political coalitions, how are we going to get businesses to either relocate or start up or expand in Pennsylvania? I know that those Keystone Opportunity Zones that we have here in Pennsylvania, which other states have similar programs, basically tax grants, bribery, which gets businesses to set up in certain areas, and then they only stay until the tax credits end and move to someplace else. How are we going to get those businesses growing here?
Good question. Because one of my answers is people talk about KOZs, Keystone Opportunity Zones, low taxes in certain areas because we need jobs in wherever. Well, how about a Keystone Opportunity Zone for Pennsylvania? And that is lower taxes for everyone. I don't know which businesses will thrive in Pennsylvania and which ones won't. I just don't know. This is when you're in business, you try different ideas. Some work, some don't.
It's also not the government's choice.
It's not the government's choice. It can't do it, and it has done a poor job. So in my view, the way to make Pennsylvania grow is to lower taxes for everybody, lower property taxes, lower franchise taxes, lower income taxes. The less money the government takes, the more opportunities there are for people who work to save and invest. And when you invest, that's where capital comes from. Capital is the result of savings. And right now we're taxing people so much that they can save less, and therefore there's less venture capital for private industry. Government has appropriated venture capital. So lower taxes for everyone.
That's
that means less spending, because without reducing spending, you can't reduce taxes. So you start with spending. I have some specific items, as I mentioned before, the universities, the Office of Economic Development, the endless borrowing that we authorize every year. Eliminate those, reduce the spending, and then you can reduce the taxes, and then Pennsylvania becomes much more business-friendly, which means more jobs and more and a higher standard of living for everybody. That's what, as you point out, that's what made America strong, economic growth.
Well, that's what's making Texas and Michigan, Wisconsin strong right now. Governor Walker is lowering taxes yet again. And there's more money available, and there's more businesses streaming there, not just because of the right-to-work aspect, which, by the way, I'm not an anti-union guy, but I like competition, and I like effective unions, and efficient unions, and not corrupt unions. And there are new unions springing up in Wisconsin which are doing well. The old ones, they're losing massive amounts of followers, which is a good thing because they're really not doing their jobs. But we have this pernicious influence. You mentioned Comcast. They have more money than God. How do we remove the pernicious influence of corrupt lobbying for corporate welfare? Obviously, poor people, their pressure is, that they're angry, and there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
But when you have somebody who can literally write a check for massive amounts of money to whatever you want, and they offer you that money, what's going to happen? We know there will be corrupt legislators and people who don't deal fairly. One thing I've noticed Governor Walker doing, in addition to simply holding the line, like you said, just saying no, is holding legislators' feet to the fire when they're doing something that is corrupt. He exposes it, and he doesn't play the political game. Are you willing to do that?
Absolutely, and I have. One of the things that I point out, first of all, when you lower taxes, there's less incentive for corporations to manipulate the system. It's hugely expensive for Comcast, and in terms of the amount of energy and time, and I'm just assuming that they would rather do what they do than spend time trying to figure out how to game the system. So if you reduce taxes, then there's less incentive, and reduce subsidies, there's less incentive for big players like Comcast to get involved. Oh, and by the way, whatever you talk about Comcast, the teachers union is a 180,000 private organization that wields huge amounts of power, probably more power than Comcast. So when you want to eliminate power, you have a problem. But one of the things that you point out is talking about the different people. For example, in Philadelphia, I'm not sure if you're following it, but the iron workers, there were 10 iron workers just indicted.
Local 401, the thugs, as they call themselves.
They call themselves the thugs. And if you read I haven't read the indictment, I'm not sure if that's online, but the paper articles point out that this is just not a single incident. There's a whole pattern and course of conduct. But the punchline is that the iron workers contributed to Dominic Pileggi, who's the Senate Republican Majority Leader. Dominic Pileggi is endorsed by the AFL-CIO. And how do I know that? It's on his Facebook page.
And he's not giving the money back, which Democrat Alison Schwartz decided to give hers to charity.
Yeah, and he's not going to give it back because he doesn't have to. There's nobody who's pointing this out and jumping up and down and saying, Senator Pileggi, you seem to be awfully close to a very violent and thuggish union. After all, birds of a feather stick together.
It's true.
It's not guilt by association. I'm certainly not saying that Senator Pileggi had any knowledge or in any way condoned what the ironworkers did, but he does seem to be awfully comfortable with them, and they are comfortable with him. And what does that tell you about either of them.
Well, the iron workers have just had a president replaced with an elected official in from New Jersey. He's actually an elected progressive who is now getting paid another salary, six figures, from the iron workers to do more of the same.
But going back to your question, So what would I do? I would start talking about, well, Senator Pelleggi is a union Republican. He's getting this money. All the Republicans in Bucks County are union Republicans. The Republicans in Delaware County are all union Republicans. Bill Adolf, the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. All these guys are part of a network that tax and spend.
One of the reasons why they had to use...
And that's what I would do. I would start talking more about that, those kinds of things, and exposing this network out there, the lobbying network of Greenlee Partners that lobbied for the Harrisburg receivership and bailed out the bondholders. We, the taxpayers of Pennsylvania, ended up bailing out the bondholders of a failed incinerator project that the voters of Harrisburg are responsible for, and then perhaps even the voters of Dauphin County, but certainly Harrisburg. So why am I bailing out your mistake? I don't get it. Why do we have to do that?
And why do we have to bail out the bondholders?
The massive
tax increase that just passed for the transportation bill, largest in Pennsylvania history, doesn't even solely fix roads and bridges. I'm now going to be paying for mass transit in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. I never use mass transit in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. It is not to my advantage. If they want it, I think it's a good thing in a city. A big city can use that. Out here, we don't have that. But one of the reasons why the iron workers had to be prosecuted federally is because most of what they did, not all, because they really went over the line. They destroyed literally hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment and buildings.
Right.
But it permits. We have a law on the books from the early 70s that permits unions to do things that are, it's beyond thuggery, they're felonies. Things that if I were to threaten somebody, harass somebody, assault somebody, under Pennsylvania law, if it's in the aegis of a union doing it, it's not illegal.
Right. I don't know about the assault part, but things that would, if you did them, would be considered harassment are not considered harassment if they're done in the course of a union dispute. There's a clear exception. The Citizens Alliance has a one or two posts on them, I believe so does the Commonwealth Foundation. It's astounding. It's astounding that this private organization can do things that if anybody else did them, they would be felonies. The assault part, I'm not sure. The assault part is, I think, going too far. But the point is all this various harassment and even things that are criminal have not been prosecuted because attorney generals of Pennsylvania don't do them. These are Pennsylvania crimes as well. They had to be prosecuted federally because no Pennsylvania law enforcement agency will stand up to the unions. I mean, that's another thing. Why? I don't understand that. I really don't. I don't know why.
Well, the Attorney General in Pennsylvania is a separate office from the governorship, and they're not subordinate, as we found out with Attorney General Kathleen Kane deciding on her own that she's going to decide on constitutionality and whether she likes a law or not, whether she's actually going to fight for what the legislature passed. That's her choice. She doesn't want to resign or ask them to change the laws. She just doesn't want to do what the law says. When we were looking at this, you're not so much talking about passing new laws. You're talking about repealing and reforming laws so that they're government doing what it is required to do at a minimum properly and nothing more.
We do not need more laws. We do not need more laws. I've read these things. You read them, and I'd say most of them are almost administrative. Why do we have 254 and 255, including the governor, deciding really administrative and bureaucratic details? That's why we have bureaucracies, because the bureaucracies are supposed to know how to run the bureaucracy.
Well, Listen, it's a very small story about a bureaucracy because I work in one, and I've got to be careful because even though I'm on final warning, I have to keep my job for until something else comes along. But and that's due to my union activity last year, anti-union. In unemployment compensation where I work, we just scrapped a system that we had a contract signed by Ed Rendell for over $150 million. And then Governor Corbett spent another close to $1 million, about $800,000, for a university study to show that the system that IBM was going to provide was absolutely not going to work. It couldn't work. It wasn't working. It was never going to work. So we spent all this money, and we bought it at a time when other states had already bought this system, experienced it, had it fail, and we're suing IBM, and yet we bought this.
Wow.
And that was the administration deciding to do this, and we're still using a system. I mean, thank God, we have, as to my knowledge, had no breaches of security. We have a lot of very personal confidential information that's important when they apply for unemployment and businesses.
Right.
And it hasn't been breached.
Hold on, gentlemen. I hate to bring this up, and everyone here knows how I hate to interrupt, but I do like to bring others in, and we can go back to that. But I do want to bring in Kelly Mordecai, another one of our panelists, bring him in. And I'll even say, a resident constitutional expert here. So, Kelly, I'm going to be opening up your line. So thank you very much, Kelly, for being on hold and calling to the show. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. We got winter weather in Northern California. Hey, Bob, before I begin, I just wanted to provide you the proper respect. Is your last name with a G, Gizzardi?
G as in gold, U, double Z as in zebra, A-R, D as in delta, I as in Indian. Gizzardi, yes.
Gizzardi, okay, all right. I want to give you that respect. All right, well, my first compliment to you is that you have a very strong pulse on the needs of Pennsylvania, and for that I really compliment you, and every gubernatorial candidate should obviously know the needs of his state. And, I've been through Pennsylvania. I lived in Maryland for 3 years, and I would go back to Iowa, my home state. I can't remember whether it was 50 or 30, but gorgeous state, really decent people. And
yeah.
So you have it's a big, too. You have a big, daunting task ahead of you. Well, I wanted to go ahead and ask you several questions.
Sure.
And these are, if you will, I'm trying to test your knowledge of the fundamental principles that made our country great. Obviously the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm hoping to get to these pretty quick. They're multiple choice or true false.
Okay.
The first five are about states' rights. The last six are regarding the U.S. Constitution, which, again, holds our fundamental principles. And, I wanted to ask you before this quiz, just tell us your thoughts on the U.S. Constitution, and you like it, you love it, you're passionate about it, good idea. What's your thoughts on the Constitution?
I think the words of the Constitution have not changed since 1791. We have had amendments, and those amendments have not changed since the time they've been enacted. Circumstances change, people change, the words haven't changed. And our challenge is to maintain those core principles in the face of an ever-changing reality. That's the basic point, and the concept one of limited government and enumerated powers. It is crystal clear that it's enumerated powers. And we seem to have gotten away from that both at the state and the local and at the federal level. But I'm focused more on the state level because these are things that I could see. I see the Pennsylvania Constitution and the laws we pass routinely violating Article 3, Section 1 and Article 3, Section 3, which are original purpose and single subject. We saw that in the transportation bill, which was the original purpose was to decide whether license plates on motorcycles could be vertical instead of horizontal. And why the legislature is even involved in that, I mean, that is a minor bureaucratic Department of Transportation issue that should be made bureaucratically, in my opinion. But that's where it started. So clearly it violated the original purpose, and in the single subject, you go look at it. You look at each of these, every bill that is passed and enacted into law has a fiscal note. Read the fiscal note on this appropriations bill. There's got to be at least 8 or 9 different categories. We changed the speed limit in Pennsylvania. Well, what does that have to do with mass transit? And what does that, I mean, these are separate issues, and the reason to vote on them separately is so that you don't have somebody saying, well, you know, like, all in all, it was a good bill, but I did things I didn't like about it. So, I mean, the idea of single subject, and that is built into the Pennsylvania Constitution.
Really awesome, because this omnibus game plan that the powers that be have is, oh, let's sneak you in 10 other things that are not even completely related. You look up omnibus, as in omnibus legislation or omnibus bill, things unrelated to the present subject. It's like, really? The dictionary calls it out, and they do it all the time. I like your position there. Well, let me ask you a question here. Would you say that the natural rights of human beings were codified, if you will, in the Constitution? I mean, they already existed. They still exist today, whether you're born, you know, 5 minutes ago or 50 years ago. The Constitution just put on paper what we already know, feel, believe, and think. It's natural. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
I think that the focus of the American Constitution, as well as the National Constitution, as well as Pennsylvania Constitution, is the divine rights of the individual, that the divine rights of autonomy, freedom of association, various items that have been enumerated in the Bill of Rights, but the focus is all on the individual. That's what the focus of the American Constitution is, as opposed to other governments, which are statist, collectivist, where the power is concentrated for other purposes, defending the realm, defending the king. The purpose of the American Constitution is individual liberty and the sanctity of the individual. That's where we start, and it is biblically based. I don't know how you can argue otherwise. It is biblically based on the idea that you know, everybody is created in the image of God, the God who has no image, but that we have a divine spark inside of us, and that's why every life is valuable. We're not ants on an anthill, and the Constitution recognizes that, and the idea is to give everybody as much autonomy as reasonably possible. We're not anarchists. It's clear that the founders understood that we needed the government, that anarchy was the law of the jungle, and it was uncivilized. But where that's drawn, and they had a scheme, which was enumerated powers, 10th Amendment, which is part of that, balance of powers, part for national, part states. This was all part of a scheme of balance of power, and we have lost all of that. And as a result, more and more power is concentrated both at the federal level and in Harrisburg and in various state capitals.
Bob, the most eloquent description of a religious base of our republic without having to use anything from the Bible that I've ever heard, and it was really touching.
Well, that's how I see it. That's how I see it, and I'm not alone.
I didn't think
of this by myself.
Wow, well, that's awesome. Okay, I'm going to start these questions, all right?
Sure.
I broke them into two sets. One is the states' rights, and then the other is about the Constitution, which, again, is the fundamental principles of our country. So, first, and there's a point to the first five with states' rights, all right? So there's multiple choice or true-false. Multiple choice. When did Pennsylvania become a state? A, 1776, 1778, 87 or 88?
When did Pennsylvania become a state? It must have been 88.
The Constitution was ratified in
88. Wait a minute. No, it would be before, because it was a convocation of the states. So I don't know when Pennsylvania actually became a state.
Let me give you a little hint, okay? All right, when did Pennsylvania become a state? July 4th, 1776, in 1778, 87, or 88?
Tell you the truth, I don't know.
This is a question.
That's a good question. I never even thought about it. Good question.
It was July 4th, 1776. In the unanimous declaration, these United Colonies honor the right out to be free and independent states, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to wage war, conclude peace, contract alliances, and to do all other acts and things which free and independent states may have right to do. That's in the glorious unanimous document, July 4th, 1776. Okay, so all 13 colonies became states that day.
Oh, okay, number good. I didn't know that. Interesting.
Yeah, there's a point to these questions. Sorry, this is the states' race.
Sure.
Number two, multiple choice. How many years did a federal government operate without an official name? 2, 4, 6, or 8 years?
Without an official name.
These are tough questions.
I don't know.
I didn't even realize it operated without an official name. I mean, I guess during the Articles of Confederation, which...
You're close. You're getting close again.
I don't know how many, 8 years?
It was 2 years where July 4th, 13 colonies became states. July 9th, the Articles of Confederation. Article 1, these United States shall be called the United States of America. So that was the official name. All right, number three. All right. True or false? In 1788, if only 8 states ratified the Constitution, all right, it's true or false, Ian, right? In 1788, if only 8 states ratified the Constitution, then the charter for the federal government would remain for a time the Articles of Confederation. True or false?
I guess true, because I think this Constitution had to be ratified by all 13 colonies. I think.
Correct. You're right. You got it. It's true. Right. So it took 9 to ratify the Articles. All right. There's a point to all this. Number 4, true or false? Per Article 7 of the Constitution, or the ratification section, each state needed to be a state to ratify the Constitution. True or false?
Yes, true.
All right. Which leads to the big question, who created whom? Did the constitutional federal government create the states, or did the states create the Constitution?
I thought the states created the Constitution. It was an agreement among the states.
That is correct. The whole point of this is that there are numerous issues that are still in the hands of the state, and the federal Constitution has limits to its own power. The states just suffered under King George the tyranny of what a centralized government could do. And so the states said, all right, we need a union, we need rules between the union, and we're going to work together, but federal government, you are going to have limited powers. So that's kind of the state's rights quiz, if you will, to help people understand sovereignty. Okay, so now,
real quick, I just want to let you know that we will be bringing Cindy in about 3 minutes. So Cindy, I see you there. So we'll be bringing in about 3 minutes. And then for the folks who are listening in either chat or in the chat or listening in from other venues, if you'd like to chime in, please do it. Call it 347-945-7428, 347-945-7428. So go ahead, Kelly. We've got a couple minutes here before we go ahead and bring Cindy in. Go ahead. And then I've got go ahead. We've got plenty of time.
Okay. So – I'm going to ask you several questions. I'm going to give you 5 points for answering correctly.
Okay.
These are going to be easy questions, all right?
Okay.
If you study your Constitution. All right. -5 points for incorrect answers, and we have 5 bonus points possible.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, if you can cite case law or 5 points for adding history supporting your answer, which obviously history is why we have so many of our amendments. All right.
Okay.
Here's the first question on the Constitution. Which amendment provides the right of petition? A, first, B, second, third, or the fourth amendment?
First amendment. Right of petition
is first. Okay, you got that right. That's +5. All right. Which amendment starts with a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state? First amendment, second amendment, third,
second amendment. Second amendment.
You got that right. That's +5 again. All right. Number 3, which amendment prohibits housing of soldiers in private homes in times of peace? First amendment, second, third, or fourth?
Fourth.
Third.
Fourth? Third, your final answer?
I said the fourth amendment.
That's fourth. Okay. Actually, that was incorrect. It was the third.
Oh,
all right.
Okay. All right.
Number four. Which amendment provides the right to be secure in your home and affects except under a judicial warrant? A, First Amendment, B, Second, Third, or the Fourth Amendment?
Fourth Amendment.
You got that one right. That's fine.
Come on, this stupid phone. Can you hear me out?
And I appreciate that, folks. This is being recorded. This is Robert back on. I don't know what the odd is. My wife's phone. I know why.
I've got my phone on speaker here.